Good afternoon, everybody. I want to welcome you to the 2007 CURB lecture on what is a very busy day on the Vanderbilt campus. There are all kinds of activities, so I think our live crowd has been affected a little bit. I'm very pleased to see we have an excellent entertainment industry turnout today. And we're also completing a podcast of this event that will be available. And we're also going to tape it and transcribe the lecture, and that will be available on the CURB Center website. So I think the commissioner's remarks will get well distributed. Of course, the CURB lecture brings speakers of interest to Vanderbilt University faculty, students, and leaders in the entertainment industry here in Nashville, and of course recognizes Mike Curb's leadership in helping to found the center here at Vanderbilt and his leadership as a Nashville philanthropist and leader within the music industry. In the past, we've had speakers like Leonard Garment, who was White House counsel in the Nixon administration, Bruce Lundvall, of course, of Blue Note Records, and then working in cooperation with Leadership Music, the training program here in Nashville, we presented Walter Yetnikoff. Today, Deborah Tate, commissioner with the U.S. Federal Communications Commission since January 3rd of 2006, and I think they've just been renominated. Somebody told me there was a rumor that you've just been renominated, so she'll be commissioner for a while longer. I'll say a little bit more about her in a moment. I just wanted to make a few comments about the record industry and the FCC. You know, the industry is really only about 100 years old here in the U.S., and broadcasting itself is a bit younger. And until the early 1940s, those two industries kind of grew side by side, but almost never spoke to one another. After all, in the 1930s, radio was just playing free music, and it probably frightened and, in a sense, damaged the record industry early on as much as internet downloading has affected the industry today. But in the mid-1940s, a guy named Dave Dexter, who was an executive with Capitol Records, had a brilliant idea. He would take 78 RPM pressings with white labels, and he and his associates would stay up all night and write, Dear Fred, KPFK, hope you like this new release. And he'd send them out in the hopes that that personal message and the free record would get played and give him his product kind of a leg up. And Capitol at that time, of course, was kind of a West Coast boutique startup label, and it was effective. And that began a connection between the music industry, the record industry in particular, and radio that has persisted to this day. But even then, I think until, say, the Payola scandals of 1959 and 60, the music industry probably didn't think all that much about the FCC. It was still off to the side dealing primarily with broadcasters. But in 1960, Congress amended the Telecom Act, Sections 317 and 507. And so it made playing songs for pay, if you didn't disclose it, made it a finable offense. And I guess things kind of got quiet again, maybe until 2007. Until there was another Payola investigation and a settlement and some sidebar agreements that, again, the FCC was right in the middle of. But I think today the FCC and the music industry are being pushed together by changes in media as never before. You know, with terrestrial radio, satellite radio, internet radio, the capacity to deliver copies as content as well as provide them for listening, I think has transformed the relationship. And then as something that really surprised me over the last couple of years, as the phone, the cell phone or phone-like devices come on to become primary mechanisms for delivering musical performances and even video performances, streamed or for download purposes, it's clear that the FCC and the music industry are going to be pushed ever closer together. So today, Debbie Tate's topic is the FCC and the music industry, and certainly that's a subject that's of great interest to us at the CURB Center, students and faculty at Vanderbilt, and an ongoing concern for Nashville's entertainment community. Now, as FCC Commissioner, and believe me, for those of you students who might not be familiar with the FCC, that's what we call a really important job. You know, that it's a, it is a big job, and because of the march of technology, it becomes a more and more important one every year. As commissioner, Deborah Taylor Tate serves as chair of the Federal-State Joint Board on Universal Service, and she's one of the commissioners who's represented the FCC officially in bilateral meetings with foreign countries and also in the role as speaker at numerous conferences. She previously served as chairman and director of the Tennessee Regulatory Authority and as legal counsel and senior policy advisors to two governors. She's often referred to as the Children's Commissioner. She was, in fact, recently recognized by Common Sense Media for her leadership in promoting online safety and children's health and families. Commissioner Tate works to facilitate market-based solutions, cooperative federalism, and public-private partnerships to address major policy issues. And, of course, she has a connection with Vanderbilt as a former director of the Vanderbilt Institute for Public Policy Studies. And she will take a few questions after her prepared remarks. Will join us outside for an informal reception. Please welcome this year's CURB lecturer, FCC Commissioner Debbie Tate.
Thank you all so much. It's really, really a pleasure to be back on campus again. As Bill said, I was over at VIPS for a period of time, and it's wonderful to see so many of my friends, personal and my colleagues, people from the music industry, and especially students. I just spoke to Northwestern a few weeks ago, and I threw out questions the whole time I was there, and I got a lot of really good feedback, and I actually used it in a hearing that we had later that day. So I want you all to feel free to speak up after I've had a chance to talk with you all a little bit. I did want to say just a sincere thanks to Bill and also to just thank Mike and Linda Curb for what they've done with their vision here at the Curb Center and beyond, and how fortunate all of us are that they adopted Nashville as their second home. Bill Ivey, obviously your leadership has been instrumental to the continued success of the Curb Center and its mission to design a new roadmap for cultural policy in America, something I think that's important to all of us. Before I went to the FCC, obviously many of these issues, especially as Bill mentioned, children and families, were so dear to my heart, and so that didn't change when I went to the FCC. There are many other Tennesseans that are impacting national and international policy, and so obviously I'm pleased to work with our congressional delegation, with my first boss, Senator Lamar Alexander. Both Bart Gordon and Marsha Blackburn serve on the Commerce Committee, which oversees the FCC and a lot of my decisions, and they are also very good friends. And of course, we miss the former Majority Leader, Bill Frist. I miss him almost daily, actually. One of the things that I wanted to say is I don't know if it was just because I got appointed to the FCC or if every single day we're in the newspaper, but last Sunday over coffee I opened the Nashville Tennessean, and there is two entire pages on some of what is going on at the FCC. And those are kind of some of the hot, sexy topics, but that's really not what I'm here to talk about. But I did want to tell you all a little bit, and especially for the students here, I don't think that I fully realized how much the FCC truly impacts every single one of our lives every single day. Some of the issues that we're dealing with right now, one that you might have remembered from last year, was the largest merger in telecom history, which was the merger of AT&T and our own Bell South, which was a $67 billion deal. I also had the opportunity to join the president at the signing of a historic bill that increased tenfold the maximum fines against purveyors of indecent material, broadcasters. And we also recently required wireless carriers to more accurately provide enhanced E911 services, something that obviously we're all concerned about. About half of the E911 calls are made from a wireless device, so that was very important for us to be to have parity across all of the providers. And then, of course, I know that many of you all have been reading about the merger between the satellite radio companies of XM and Sirius. we are obviously in the process of looking at that. The other really kind of historic, monumental task that we have in front of us is our media ownership rules. And yesterday, actually, we had our final localism hearing at the FCC. Appropriately, on Halloween, we had people dressed in costume, and we even had FCC cheerleaders doing cheers there. So it was quite a Halloween at the FCC. As you know, we are trying to decide whether or not to limit the current limits on the number of television radio stations that can be owned in a market, and also whether or not the existing ban on cross-ownership is relevant and necessary. Another issue that Bill mentioned, and I won't go into because it's very, very tedious, is called universal service. But I'm really committed not only to protecting this fund against fraud and abuse, but every single one of you all, if you pull out your phone bill, you'll see that you pay into the universal service fund. And so I think it's crucial that we really get control of the untenable growth that is going on. It's a $7 billion fund right now. Most of you all probably aren't focused on where you're going to be on February 17th of 2009, although Whit and Bud, two members of broadcasters I know, are. But that's the date of our DTV transition, and I actually have brought some packets. I don't go anywhere, I want you all to know, without talking about the DTV transition. This is important to every one of us. And you all, as leaders, as students, I hope you all will help us get the word out. We have a really simple website, www.dtv.gov, going to help you about how your televisions are going to work and what you need in terms of a converter box. So I brought some packets to leave for you all. And just yesterday, the FCC ended exclusive cable contracts into apartment buildings, once again to kind of level the playing field so that new entrants like the telecom companies can now begin providing video in apartment buildings. Many of you all know, who have known me in the past, that children and family issues are very close to me, and I really have continued to work on those at the FCC. One of the things that we did was establish a task force on childhood obesity. Probably in the next couple of weeks or a month, we will have a formal either recommendation or report out. But I don't know if you all remember, during August, there were a number of companies, food and beverage companies, Kellogg, Kraft, and then as well as media companies, who have agreed to provide healthier advertising, more balance in the advertising, especially to children. And also not to use licensed characters for unhealthy foods. So we are really excited. And once again, this is an example of, rather than heavy-handed either legislation or regulation by government entities like the FCC, really pulling industries together to talk about this. With over 10 million children in this country either obese or at risk of being obese, I felt like I was really called to try to bring these industries together, industries that obviously I meet with and work with every single day. So I'm excited about that. Actually, our very own locally produced VeggieTales, I don't know if you all realize, but Ion Media is actually right out at the factory in Franklin, and they were the very first ones to say that they would not use their characters to advertise any unhealthy food. So I try to find the good and praise it whenever I can. I'm also continuing to work with media industry executives, producers, and writers about the disturbing rise in violence in today's entertainment media, and looking for ways for parents to protect their children. Obviously, as you all know, every television has a V-chip now, but it is absolutely amazing, some of the statistics, that a third of children under three have a television in their room, two-thirds of children between 8 and 18 do. It is just an incredible amount of screen time, as we say. By the time a child enters first grade, they've watched nearly 5,000 hours of television. So I think that many of us just don't realize some of the effects that they're having, a sedentary, inactive lifestyle on their physical health and then also on their mental and emotional health. So I want to encourage the industry to do all that they can. Internet safety is also another one of kind of the hot topics on the Hill right now. 3 weeks ago, I was invited to keynote at a congressional forum with organizations like the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, iKeepSafe.org, WebWise Kids. We all discussed the latest technological developments to protect children against online predators. You know, a parent's job has never been harder than it is today with all of this new, exciting digitization that is going on in our world, but it is also a challenge. And then I wanted to say just a moment, just talk for a moment about the FCC in kind of an international role. Usually one of the first questions that I'm asked is, what were you most surprised about when you got to the FCC? And I guess, and I really didn't realize, I really thought most everything that we would do would be domestic, but that we have such a role, and it's an important role, regarding international issues. Just in the short time that I've been at the Commission, I've been able to travel to Beijing, to Brazil, to three different areas in Brazil. Paris, next week I will go to the Global Forum on Convergence in Venice, and then on to the World Radio Conference, which I'm really excited about, in Geneva. And then we absolutely are seeing international visitors come almost weekly at the FCC. 12 African ministers, the new chairman in Lebanon, ministers from Sweden, Japan, Azerbaijan. It's just incredible. And I think one of the things that I'm most proud of at the FCC is the expertise, because in many ways we're on the cutting edge that we have had, whether it's in spectrum auctions or other technologies, that we are able to put our engineers and their engineers together to talk the same language. That has been a really exciting, you know, something that I really didn't expect about my job. And as different as we all are, I think what has really been incredible to me is, no matter what language, no matter what country that I'm meeting with, we have so many of the same issues. We are all in the throes of deciding whether to update our telecom laws with all of the new technology that is going on. Many of us are going through a DTV transition. Sweden has already gone through there, so we may actually learn something from them. Spectrum licensing, as you all know, we just had the largest spectrum auction, and we'll have another one next year. And then, of course, improving all of our citizens' access to this technology so that no one is left behind, whether they're in Africa or they're in Appalachia. And then on the domestic side, obviously, we are constantly facing and trying to adapt regulations to all the unprecedented changes in technological innovations, all the while balancing that, obviously, with in the public interest, which is our standard. These disruptive technologies impact not only the marketplace, but obviously corporate business models, something that Bill was referencing, and obviously us as regulators and our regulatory schemes. The DTV transition not only affects the fidelity and quality of the video that you all as consumers are going to see in 09, but also our complex auction rules that actually are based on game theory, winning economic theory, which we employ to allocate that spectrum. Again, one of the many ways that international countries want to learn from us. Many of them have, for instance, just been handing out licenses, or actually in many countries, it is the government that is providing the services. Let me now turn to what we are going to discuss this afternoon, and that is piracy. Everyone here is well aware of all the technological advances that are impacting the music and the video industry. As the mother of three college-age children now, I'm constantly bombarded with all the latest devices or programs, or, hey, let me show you this, Mom, or scary, the social networking sites that now kids all use. In the midst of all these incredible consumer benefits of this new digital age, many of you know that piracy is a very real and present danger. Because I'm from Music City and have witnessed it right here firsthand with my friends, with the music industry, and all those associated jobs and service industries, everywhere I go, I've been declaring a war on piracy. The numbers are absolutely staggering, and I will just share a few with you. But a 2006 report by IFPI, the International Federation of the Phonographic Industry, over one-third of all CDs purchased in 2005 were pirated. A third. Pirated CD sales outnumbered legitimate sales in 30 worldwide markets. And for illegally downloaded songs, two-thirds of the 20 billion illegal downloads are of U.S. recorded music. Billions in dollars of thefts from our artists, songwriters, publicists, the secondary markets. In Tennessee alone, we've suffered $203 million in lost earnings due to piracy, and that's just the piracy of the sound recordings. It has cost the U.S. economy over 70,000 jobs. And of course, that's just not affecting the music industry and our artists. Today, the impact of piracy is filtering down through so many other industries. And actually, I think this is what is really helping us get a toehold in the conversation in Washington and abroad, from the travel industry to the food industry to retail to tax receipts for state budgets. The study that I referenced found that sound piracy cost U.S. workers $2.7 billion in earnings. $1.6 billion of that would have been earned by workers in other industries than the music industry. Recently, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce reported the following losses due to counterfeiting and piracy. Apparel and footwear, $12 billion. Artistic recordings, 4.6, motion pictures, 6.1, software, 34 billion, auto, 12 billion, pharmaceuticals, $32 billion. So, all of this together, between $2 and $250 billion per year. Here in Nashville, the effects are particularly tangible, as I said, because we know people. Country albums are down 26%, gospel is down 23%. This means fewer artists signed to labels, songwriters struggling to make ends meet, and industry executives cutting back on new investment. Where investment declines, creativity suffers, society suffers, and I believe we all suffer. And piracy, unfortunately, as we all know, isn't just occurring right here on American soil. But as I mentioned in my travels, I'm finding out really how large this is. In Brazil, where 1.3 billion music tracks are illegally downloaded each year, half of all discs and CDs sold in Brazil are counterfeit. And how does this affect all of us? Well, in 2003, the piracy in Brazil cost U.S. companies $700 million in sales. When I was in Beijing, I literally was sick walking through the markets, seeing thousands of counterfeit CDs, clearly an accepted part of the marketplace there. So, in all of these countries, when I have the opportunity, whether it's formally in bilateral negotiations with these ministers, or whether it's more informally as we're toasting one another at night, I hand out goo-goos and country music CDs, thanks to Joe and many other people here in Nashville. And I ask them for whatever that particular country is. For instance, in Brazil, to the Minister of Brazil, I'm bringing you legal music. I hope you enjoy it. It's from my hometown of Nashville, Tennessee. And did you know that there were 1.3 billion illegal downloads? I hope that they will help us. I'm trying to talk about this everywhere I go, as government leaders and as moral leaders. And at least in Sao Paulo, I'm happy to report that the American Chamber has already hosted a forum on the topic. So hopefully one day we'll see those numbers decreasing. And it may be dangerous to suggest, given my current surroundings, but in addition to foreign soil, university campuses are obviously another hotbed of piracy in this country. College students have all the right demographics and characteristics: heavy consumers of entertainment, operating on low budgets or parental budgets, trying to save money, and savvy users of all types of software. Plus, those that have consumers in their rooms can be downloading content 24 hours a day, even while they're in class or they're asleep. And as colleges continue to upgrade their networks and increase capacity, I often wonder how much of that is being used for illegal downloads. This also results in a financial drain on university resources. Dr. Early. I'm pleased, and I do want to thank Vanderbilt, because I think Vanderbilt was the first, or one of the very first, is that right, Bill? Who actually employed the legal downloading program that is now being utilized by many universities. We just need to get the other 6,300 universities to follow Vanderbilt's lead. Another method in what I call the war on piracy is effective media literacy in the lower grades. You know, my kids are what I really call the iGen, the internet generation, because they just grew up on the internet. They found information. It was like the encyclopedia. You know, and I think that many of us really didn't realize what they were doing until now. I'm hoping that perhaps through our own E-Rate program, as you all know, we provide funds to connect most every school in America to the internet, will not only require the filtering tools that we do now, but that also we will add media literacy to that. So it's not just the tool itself, but it's using the tool to teach a very important lesson. I think obviously all of us can do more. It is no longer just a craze, but it is punishable criminal behavior. I even had, this is so incredible because I didn't even think about this until I was writing this speech when I was going to Brazil. But actually when I was here working on this GIS project over at VIPS, I had to have this incredible amount of storage capacity. One day I got a call from Vanderbilt IT, and they were very concerned about what was going on with one of these huge computers that we had over at VIPS, and so they came over. And my computer had actually been hijacked and was being used to store complete first-run movies, that some of which were just like that day being opened in movie theaters, and I was absolutely shocked about it. And so obviously, if it can happen to me, it can happen to anyone. Overcoming the massive industry plague requires all types of innovative solutions. I was really pleased to see the announcement of an anti-piracy coalition made up of media giants, CBS, Disney, Fox, Microsoft, and NBC Universal. The industry coalition will focus on technological developments that will prevent public use of copyrighted content. They've already released a set of guidelines that will require websites to use filtering technology to block the posting of unauthorized clips. As Jeff Zucker, President and CEO of NBC, said, this announcement marks a significant step in transforming the internet from a Wild West to a popular medium that respects the rule of law. Google, owner of YouTube, the largest video sharing website, has not joined the coalition yet, but they have, however, committed to employing a filtering system that gives owners of copyrighted videos the choice of promoting or blocking their content. I was out at Google at the complex a couple of weeks ago and had the chance to meet with Larry Page and some of their attorneys, and obviously once again brought up my war on piracy. And they discussed a new watermarking technology that will essentially tag copyrighted material, making it easy to identify by IP investigators. These developments really do give me hope that as we move forward with more and more technology, that there will be solutions to these problems. I've encouraged and begged and cajoled most everyone that I've met since I've been at the FCC to be part of the solution. I'm also encouraged by an entirely new business dedicated to fighting piracy, and that is SafeNet, one of the entertainment industry's primary piracy investigators, which was founded by two National Security Agency engineers in a basement in Maryland, and is responsible for the recent highly publicized indictment of a Minnesota woman who illegally downloaded music. The U.S. Department of Justice is joining the fight as well. Earlier this year, they logged their 50th conviction for online piracy. The most recent conviction came as a part of Operation Fast Link, an ongoing DOJ crackdown against organized piracy groups responsible for most of the initial illegal distribution of movies, first-run movies, software, games, and, of course, music. Operation Fast Link resulted in more than 120 search warrants executed in 12 different countries, and the removal of more than $50 million worth of illegal distribution channels. Not only is this diverting funds from creators and artists, but in many cases, it is actually diverting funds to illegal organized crime syndicates. And right here at Vanderbilt, again, I want to say thank you to Vanderbilt at the law school in conjunction with the World Intellectual Property Organization and the International Confederation of Societies of Authors and Composers. They co-sponsored a major conference to discuss changes to the copyright laws, collective rights management practices, and business models capable of meeting the needs of today's copyright owners. I'm proud of the law school's keen interest, and especially those issues that are significant to Nashville. As you can see, I'm really committed to taking action. I believe that we must start looking at piracy as a crime of theft that is threatening not just to the future of musicians and our music industry, but to all the other industries in America that I mentioned earlier. And consider what's been accomplished in Ireland, where they began cracking down on piracy. Since 2000, the rate of piracy dropped 30%. Just a few weeks ago, the Irish Recorded Music Association claimed a huge victory when a man was sentenced to prison for selling over 200 illegally copied CDs and DVDs. The director of the association, discussing piracy's impact on musicians, said, "It is stealing from people who make a livelihood from music, so we will do everything in our power to seek out and prosecute anyone involved in unlawful music practice." The association made a commitment earlier this year that they won't tolerate any form of music piracy. I consider myself an ambassador for Nashville everywhere I go, and for Music City, and for the industry that is the very fabric of our great city. And of course, I can't limit my ambassadorship to any one genre. It must go beyond just country music when you think about the fact that most of our popular music in the world was born here in Tennessee or very nearby, from the bluegrass in Appalachia to the blues of Memphis to the gospel music I heard up hearing in church to, of course, Elvis and rock and roll. What a rich and valuable resource is woven all around us. Similar to monetized natural resources that our country protects and values, whether it's coal or oil or water, music and songs and stories and now videos warm us, heal us, quench our thirst, and light our way. So my message from Washington to Warsaw is that we must protect and save these treasures. They're our great natural resources. They are our art, our history, our music. In my opinion, they're our silver and our gold. This city, the Athens of the South, is truly a cultural epicenter. It's home to over 80 record labels, 180 recording studios, to the new president of the Country Music Association, Randy Goodman, and the birthplace, obviously, of the world-famous Grand Ole Opry. I've been told that half of the population of the U.S. lives within 650 miles of Nashville. So clearly, we're the lucky half. I'm so proud to be a Nashvillian. I'm glad to be back on Vanderbilt campus, and I always hope that I will represent you well wherever I go. Thank you, Bill.
Commissioner Tate has agreed to take a few questions. Yeah, Lon?
I'm kind of curious, in the ruling of the last couple of days prohibiting apartment buildings and condos from making exclusive contracts with cable providers, you guys took an incredibly strong step. I think making it even stronger was the fact that you, if I read this correctly, have said that you would, in effect, are canceling all previous contracts like that. My question to you would be, that's a very bold step. You did a great job outlining all the problems. I'm wondering if the government, in the absence of any marketplace fixes, if the FCC can step in to really help an industry that is desperate in need of help. Is there any bold move like that that you're considering or could consider to really help the music industry?
Wow. That's a really big question. You know, I don't know. So far, I'm one of five, and actually I am supposed to start each speech with the disclaimer of I'm just one FCC commissioner. You know, and I guess that that's something that I would, you know, for instance, look to Bill or look to those of you in the industry to say what, you know, what are some bold steps, for instance, that the FCC could take. You know, the one that I suggested that has to do with E-rate just happens to be something that's under our legal authority, and I kept trying to think about what could we do, and that was the one entree that I thought that we might, you know, be able to do, that we have legal authority over, I might add. So, you know, I welcome your input. I mean, I try to meet with people when I'm home to hear what's going on in the industry. I do try to take the message. I mean, you know, this is a bully pulpit. Some people wonder why I'm involved in childhood obesity, you know, but I feel like because of the relationship that the FCC has with the media and with many of the entities that advertise on the media, for instance, that's our tie to that issue. I welcome any thoughts or ideas, and I'm happy to hear anything that you all think that we might be able to do.
You know, a question that I would ask, I think this would be helpful for the students who are here, is that if an idea were to come at you from the music industry and it were something that fell within your legal authority, what would the process be? What would happen? You know, you'd get an idea, you'd carry it back, there are five commissioners. How would this play out?
Well, that's really interesting because usually it's not so much an idea as it is, for instance, on the indecency side, it is responding to a complaint, for instance. It is a filing of a petition that is made at the FCC. You know, I could see it being a request for a declaratory ruling, for instance, to interpret a certain regulation or statute that might be of some benefit, you know, to the music industry. You know, I guess sui sponte, I could suggest something. You know, so I welcome that. I'd love to be part of more of a discussion with you all.
Deborah, I don't know if you're familiar with it, but the Canadian music industry is well down the road and have been encouraged by the government to draft a bill that basically, they're calling it monetizing peer-to-peer file sharing. And basically what they're saying is they're going to charge a little tax to the consumer, a small VIP provider would have to add a small surcharge to everybody's cable bill, and then it would be representatively distributed to the people according to their contribution. Are you familiar with that? And also, would that fall under the purview of the FCC? Would that arrive at the FCC first, or would that be a legislative issue?
Yes, it would be a legislative issue. Yeah, we are. Our entire legal authority is subject to congressional legislation that passes. I'm very interested in this, and actually it's so interesting. Yesterday or the day before, the French delegation was in, and my colleagues there, some of them, and I was telling them that remarkably, I have never met with our Canadian counterparts, and that's something, and now maybe this will give me a reason, you know, an issue to call them about and say I'd really like some more information. But yes, and I mean, I'm sure that on the Hill, I mean, I know there's so many pieces of legislation that have been floating around trying to touch this issue in different ways. But, I will certainly call my colleagues and get some of that information. And the other thing, I remember reading an article. This wasn't so much about piracy as it was Ireland just as a country saying, we used to have such an impact on literature in the world, and we've lost all of our authors and writers. And so trying to give them tax incentives to come back to Ireland, that was something else that, you know, I thought might be interesting. Once again, certainly not under our purview, but, you know, Congress does, you know, allow tax incentives for all types of industries and economic development, for instance.
Yeah, Bruce?
I enjoyed your talk. I found your remarks on piracy interesting, although I will tell you candidly that I'm a little disappointed to hear you sort of be so one-sided on it, which is to say, to almost parrot recording industry propaganda on the issue. A lot of statistics about lost business, which are based in sort of semi-ludicrous assumptions that every pirated, you know, recording would have been purchased at full price or something. But I mean, when I'm thinking about your role as an FCC commissioner, do you see the recording industry as at all culpable? Or is it all about criminalizing and policing consumers to solve the problem of piracy?
Well, you know, one of the things that I mentioned was how I try to work with the industry, whatever the particular issue may be. So while I've spoken out everywhere across America on childhood obesity, I'm sure there are a lot of people who wonder why she's doing that. But you know what? I think that I've really had an impact. And I really felt called to do that when I heard that this is the first generation, according to the Institute of Medicine, who won't survive, won't live longer than the previous generation. And so I guess part of this is what you feel called to do when you're someplace. And, you know, you may dispute the recording industry's estimates, but the U.S. Chamber has also monetized all types of other industries. So I think I just look at it as anything that is affecting us to the tune of $250 billion a year, I look at it as an issue that I think America should be concerned about. I certainly appreciate, and I certainly hear from a lot of people who feel, I think, the way that you do.
I don't favor piracy. I'm not an advocate. I just see its origins as coming from different
places. Good, because otherwise I'd need to protect you from people over here.
That's like a battle of the bands, you know. We have industry and universities.
Does the FCC have a regulatory role? I mean, it's a very interesting issue. It has to do with communications, but I'm not sure I see. Help me understand the FCC's role, specifically on the subject of piracy, since it doesn't involve communications over airwaves.
Well, one thread that I tried to connect the dots with was our E-rate funding to the schools, and then I felt like it was important that not only do we provide or require the schools to have these filtering tools, but that they also teach kids about why we have to have these tools.
Another question to you, yes.
Hi, you did a great speech. I enjoyed it a lot. Just want to say that first. What is the FCC trying to do to sort of, if they are trying to reduce animosity between like college students and the recording industry? Because like as a college student, I think the feeling that a lot of students have is that the recording industry is like unfairly going after the consumer when the distributors, like why sue students when they're getting it, you know, why not go after the distributor? They're the people who are sending it out mass, you know, and kids, you know, students are getting sued, and there builds up like anger towards the recording industry as to why they're going after students. Like I think Ruckus is a step in the right direction. I think that's what it's called when we're using Vanderbilt. But is there anything the FCC is trying to do to try to, you know, maybe bridge the gap between the recording industry and college students who feel that they're being unfairly targeted?
You know, I think this is a great idea, and maybe what Bill and I can talk about. I mean, maybe what we ought to do is have a forum and have a dialogue. you know, so that students do have an opportunity to discuss and hear about these issues. I'm interested to hear the students in the room. Did it make any impact on you at all that this is a loss to the U.S. economy, like manufacturing jobs going away, plants closing, people losing their jobs? I mean, does this resonate? Maybe you all don't want to say this out loud, but yes,
you
I'm really.
Answer that question.
Yeah, I do. Okay. I've worked in manufacturing for two summers to help pay for school, and there is a massive difference in the eyes of many students between CDs being sold for 15 cents on the streets of Beijing and us downloading music because we can't afford it or things like that. And I'm not saying that's necessarily right, but there is a schism there. And what we need to do is have a dialogue where the industry can listen to students about problems and how the industry is presenting the music. If this music is incredibly popular in Beijing at 15 cents, bring the artists out there and start throwing concerts, you know? Students feel like, yes, we are being targeted, but we can't speak out, especially here at Vanderbilt, because Vanderbilt has so many friends in the industry. We don't want to hurt our school's relationship, especially those of us who are dependent on financial aid and grants and things like that.
Very wise. And I really appreciated your compliment before you made your comment. So you've been taught very well.
One more comment. Then we'll just have one more question. I know Commissioner Tate has already given another speech today.
If I could be one student's perspective, thank you for coming. It was great. But I'm an economics major, and from what I've learned here, the market isn't necessarily nice to people who may be in an industry that isn't at the cutting edge. My idea is that the music industry is changing. Music is becoming both a public and durable good, to borrow a term from economics. And I feel that the business model that the recording industry is using to deal with this sort of issue is something that might be kind of anachronistic. And I wonder how long it can survive in this sort of business model.
You know, and you bring up such a good point. I mean, the whole issue with convergence and with the new digital technologies, I mean, we're all struggling with this. You know, that's what I said before. It's new business models for every type of business in America to be able to survive, you know, to provide these bundled packages. In fact, now it's not just the triple play, it's the quadruple play, you know. And so I think you're right. I think that all of the industries that are involved in any of these issues are really having to rethink and think about, is this going to be the business model going forward? But I really appreciate this. And, you know, Bill, maybe this would be something great. I know that Cox Cable had a team summit recently on safety on the Internet issues. And, you know, they might want to co-sponsor something maybe.
Sure.
To continue the conversation with students.
And I think it's great for the students. So if you knew who the people behind you were.
I'm sure.
Well, we've got two or three label heads. Does anybody want to make a comment?
I honestly think a forum between students and record labels in town is a great idea.
Yeah.
Because for you to hear from our perspective and us to hear from your perspective, and we're on two opposite ends of the spectrum, and I think you'd get a better appreciation from where our business model and how it works. Because I think a lot of people just have no appreciation whatsoever for the amount of investment that goes in from a record company standpoint. And We have a great appreciation for the fact that the model is changing, and it's from our perspective it's broken, and the digital realm is not picking it up. But I think for us to communicate is a great idea, especially in this town. I think
that's what I think is so cool.
Well,
if it were Nashville,
we'll do it.
There you go. You made a difference in public policy just by coming.
I think I'd like to have one more question, then we'll visit with Commissioner Tate over a little wine and decide what.
I wanted to comment on the new media ownership regulations that are coming down. What's could you fill us in on that? Because I haven't read the paper in 2 or 3 days.
Well, we had our final localism hearing yesterday at the FCC. We have one more media ownership hearing that we committed to having. We've been all across the country. Y'all may remember we were here at Belmont last year. You know, and then it will be a process of coming up with rules. The chairman was hoping to have those done before the end of this year, as in December. He also committed that there would be a period of time to review those rules. So obviously, as days click by before we can even have the last public hearing, that just pushes the date out a little farther. So you didn't miss anything in the past couple of days.
Do you have a feeling for how is it striking you, what you've heard so far through these hearings and
about localism? The people who attend the hearings, for the most part, are passionate.
Yeah.
You know, media touches every one of our lives every day. And so people are very passionate about it. I think that we also need to step back away from the passion and also just look at, you know, what the marketplace is like. So anyway,
another 3-2 slam dunk? Is that what it's going to be?
I'm not sure.
Thanks, Commissioner Tate.
Absolutely. Appreciate it.
We do have refreshments right outside. And I hope the commissioner can stay with us.
Well,